Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Okay, guys, I want to welcome Bob Murphy back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. We've got a lot to talk about. Bob, what happened to the days when the only person we had to worry about was Paul Krugman?
I know, it's looking back, it was a good one, because he had some zany ideas, but he, you know, he wasn't really influencing too much, actually.
Yeah.
And I think I don't know if you agree with this, George, but I think partly the reason is because he's such a loose cannon. Like in other words, if I were part of the elite cabal, I wouldn't want to have Krugman too close because he can't keep his mouth shut. Like, he's too pleased with himself. You know what I mean? Like, they'd be kicking him on and say, Paul, we're not those people.
Yeah. So I wanted to first get into this series that you did on your podcast, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Everyone's got to listen to it. I think it was a 5 or 6 part series where you kind of did a deep dive into not only Klaus, but his new book, or I think it came out maybe a year ago, year or two ago, the COVID-19, the Great Reset. And then you kind of transitioned that into his, I don't know if you want to call it a consultant with this Noah, I think his name is Noah Harari, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And what fascinated me probably most about that is you said that prior to doing the research, you're kind of on the fence. You're like, I don't know, this conspiracy theory, kind of tinfoil hat, Alex Jones stuff. And then once you started really reading the World Economic Forum's website and his book, you're like, you kind of gradually were like, wait a minute, maybe this is something that it isn't necessarily a conspiracy theory, but something that's something that's legit as far as the objectives of, we'll call it the quote unquote global elite. You want to walk us through that process?
Yeah, sure. And thanks for the kind words. So, right. It just to clarify, like what you said is true, but I'm concerned some of your listeners might misunderstand. So it's,
yeah.
I mean, obviously Alex Jones is way over the top and stuff. I don't know. My favorite thing recently, my wife and I will occasionally do impressions where like, I will have to eat my neighbor. You know, if it comes down to it, I'm going to eat my neighbor. This is the global, the corner they push it into. So he's obviously putting on a show and all that stuff. So we know that, but he really has, it's a kind of thing where, you know, a lot of stuff, he doesn't look as crazy now as he did 10 years ago. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, right.
And but I think though what you're alluding to is that two different things. So one is that, yeah, like a decade plus ago, I of course was a free market economist, but I thought a lot of the people in power were just misguided. Whereas, you know, I don't believe that anymore, you know, for most of the people in power. But for this series in particular, I had heard of Klaus Schwab and the Great Reset and all this stuff, but I just, originally, when he first came on my radar, I don't know, this is maybe 2-3 years ago, I didn't think too much of it just because I thought, oh, well, there's lots of academics out there with crazy, zany ideas. And I thought he was kind of like academia or maybe some kind of business leader. And I didn't really care too much. You know, I said, yeah, I don't agree with his ideas. But like I said, there's all kinds of people from business or academia. I don't care about their ideas. But then the thing that really started making me take him seriously was when I realized he was connected with the British royal family, you know, Prince Charles, who was, you know, going to the WEF, the World Economic Forum, WEF, and was, you know, and really they were united on ostensibly on the issue of climate change and how we got to push through all these radical changes in how our world functions, or else, you know, we're all, our grandkids are going to inherit a planet that's unsustainable or uninhabitable. And so that's really what, when I realized, okay, he actually has connections to government power. And so I want to take him more seriously. And then once I just started going down that rabbit hole, he's got ties to all sorts of people. So just real quickly, and then, you know, you can take the conversation, George, every way you want. But Klaus, he's got a PhD in engineering and economics. So he's a smart guy. You know, I've seen interviews with him. He knows many languages fluently. You know, he's a very cosmopolitan guy. He's very diplomatic. Like if you see him, if he's given an address, you know, to people in UAE or something, he's very, your excellencies, your highnesses, and the ruler of Dubai, and you know,
and
what I mean?
Use
very
that clip from him speaking down in Dubai, where he referenced the head sheikh down there, and it, you know, the full 5-word, phrase.
Well, right. Yes. Describes all of his titles. Yeah. What is he? The ruler of Dubai and the something of
your
UAE.
Royal Highness, highest, Majesty, blah, 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 blah.
So he's a very, you know, he's a smooth player, and he's and what he did for people, you know, so he founded the World Economic Forum. But going back, and let me just mention this so I don't forget, I found a great piece by this guy, Johnny Vedmore. The site's called Unlimited Hangout, and it's about Klaus Schwab and How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bombs. Like, so he's doing an allusion to Dr. Strangelove. And in this article, Johnny goes through and the three mentors that Klaus Schwab had, and the primary one was Henry Kissinger. And so Klaus openly says that when he was, in the United States, after he'd gotten his, I think he's got his other 2 degrees, and then he took a seminar that Kissinger ran, and later it came out that the CIA funded this seminar. So in full disclosure, it's not crystal clear that the years that Klaus was, or the year, I guess, that Klaus was there was when the CIA was funding it necessarily, but there's an overlap there. And Klaus openly says that this is what, you know, was Kissinger's class that got me involved in geopolitics and whatever. So he's like a consultant. And I think really the way to picture is he's a power broker. Like, I saw a different article use that phrase, and I think that's what he is. And, you know, he's very smooth and has a talent for just being real matter of fact, you know, just talking to, like when you say talking to that clip that I had where he's talking to the Middle Eastern rulers, political officials and whatnot, and just telling them, you know, you got to build public trust. This is what we need to do. And look at the Dubai's doing a great job in terms of competitiveness. And that's the last thing I'll mention here in this opening salvo here is that he's not a Marxist. Okay. So you can call him a socialist if you want. I got no problem with that, but they understand, like, you got to allow decentralization somewhat, you know, the profit motive and things. It's just, they feel, oh, it all needs to be tempered with some other systems that help, you know, keep, you know, you got to have somebody in charge. Like, they don't, you know, we can't just have anarchy. So anyway, and you mentioned that, and some of the creepiest quotes are from a guy who is very connected with the WEF, this guy Harari, this Israeli academic. He's written several books. And basically what they're doing is they're painting a vision of the future where, because of these, what Klaus calls the fourth industrial revolution, all these advances in biotechnology and AI and things like that, that there's going to be this like new breed of humans that are in a sense a different species. And I'm not putting words in their mouth. Like, this is how they talk.
Yeah. He says we need to take control of evolution ourselves.
Yeah.
And we need to evolve. And there's going to be some people that are just left behind. And when he's referencing the people, maybe in third world countries, he's like, well, they're just basically worthless. And, you know, even I think you referenced those quotes exactly. And when you were saying that, and when I've heard him say that, my first kind of inclination is, okay, well, maybe this is being taken out of context here. Let's just give him the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. But even if it's taken out of context, if you listen to the words he uses to describe other people, I would never call another human being worthless, like never in any context. And it's not just, he calls them worthless. And he uses other phrases that are along those lines. And then he kind of concludes by saying, well, I guess they're just going to have to play video games and take massive amounts of drugs or something. And it's just, I don't know. I think there's a lot that you can learn from someone just by listening to how they describe other people.
Right. And again, for your listeners, so there you're referring to Harari, the academic who's really tied in close with the WEF. And right, he's sitting there lamenting. Like, that's the thing, is these they're like central planners on steroids. And so I think, and you're right, with one's normal inclination is to say, okay, let's not jump to conclusions here. And yeah, some of these quotes, but I think it really is just their worldview, and it sort of follows from it. Like, if they truly believe, whatever, 50, 100 years from now, there's going to be such a huge chasm between the people who are plugged. And that's another thing too, that Klaus Schwab talks about, is that some will embrace this change and others will resist. And so he's almost making it sound like it's a matter of choice. And he's saying, hey, the ones who resist, the ones who don't want to, you know, alter their DNA or augment themselves with, you know, putting chips in their brain or whatever, and being able to have supervision because you augment your eyeballs and whatever, that, you know, there's going to be such a huge chasm. And so they're picturing this future world. And it's sort of like the leftist trope of, oh, if the gap between the haves and the have nots get too big, they're going to be unruly. And that's why we need a welfare state. That's kind of where that Harari guy was coming from. He said, yeah, it's going to be no problem feeding these people. Like, so to his credit, you know, he's not a Malthusian. He understands, oh, with technology and AI and robots and all this stuff, it's going to be no problem feeding 10 billion plus people. That's nothing. But he's saying, what are we going to do with them? They're just going to, as you say, George, they're going to have meaningless lives, and they're just basically useless people. What are we going to do? And then, yeah, his conclusion, and again, this is the Harari guy talking, his conclusion was give them video games and drugs. So if that's the world they're envisioning, a lot of the things that are being put in place now make sense. And like, you can understand why they would want a world, as Klaus Schwab famously said, where you'll own nothing and be happy. Because you want people just living in little pods, you know, like 10 by 10 rooms where they're just plugged into the metaverse 20 hours a day, you know, and they don't need to own a car.
So remember the Matrix where they're in those pods and
yeah.
In the first one.
Right. Right. And it's very similar to that. So I don't think they need human bodies like as batteries. That's the one part of the Matrix that I never really sat well with me is like, why would the machines need it? You know, couldn't they come up with a better way of generating energy? But I guess storing it. But in any event, it's, you know, I guess it's no fun to rule the world if it's just you and your cronies. Like, so maybe they do want to have billions of people that are kind of, you know, semi zombies. But in any event, it's, in case some of your listeners are hearing this and thinking you and I are just went off the deep end. I mean, again, we're not grasping at straws. They openly talk like this in terms of what, you know, the future they envision. And again, it's always cast as this humanitarian cloak of, you know, oh, what are we going to do for these poor people? And that's why they're in favor of things like UBI and such, is that, oh, because the claim is once AI and robotics continues to advance past a certain point, then there's a lot of humans who will have zero economic value, right? That there's just nothing they can contribute because machines can do it so much better and, you know, more reliably and whatever that, you know, in other words, like their marginal product, economically speaking, will be basically below subsistence level. And so they'll just need the system to take care of them. And then what are we going to do with these people? They might get uppity. And so let's distract them with video games and whatever. So in any event, that's kind of the vision. And it's, you can see, again, if this were just some crazy guy off writing science fiction novels, it would be one thing. But this guy, Klaus Schwab, is very plugged in. For example, he started this thing called the Young Global Leaders Initiative, where they selected people, and he openly bragged. It was funny, Jordan. I was going to do this as like a research for my podcast. You know, what's my value add for the listeners? I was going to go through the archives of all the graduates from his program and then look and see where are they now.
Oh, but Trudeau, Macron,
right.
Angela Merkel, Putin,
had,
by the way.
Yeah, and he did that on his own. Klaus was being interviewed in front of us. Again, this stuff's not secret. He's openly bragging. And he said, yes, well, I'm very proud that our, you know, some of the graduates of our Young Global Leaders Initiative have penetrated the cabinets of many major governments around the world. And that's his verb. He said penetrated the cabinets, not because of our training. You know, they convinced others of the reasonableness of our views or our policy recommendations. No, he said our graduates penetrated the cabinets, which is like how intelligence agents talk.
Yeah, right.
You know, so again, that's, this is just how the guy talks.
Yeah. You know, another thing that led me to those conclusions, or again, there's no certainties, there are only probabilities. But this is kind of my base case, is that he's got a massive amount of influence, is when I started to notice like the Trudeau types and the political leaders and the CEOs using the exact same terminology. It's like, it's a script. It's like, mm-hmm. Before I retired, I had a call center with about 40 telemarketers. And we would have a script that would pop up, you know, when someone was calling in, and the telemarketer would literally read the script because you wanted everyone saying the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear Trudeau using the exact same script as Klaus, I hear Biden saying it. I hear Mark Benioff with Salesforce saying it. I hear, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, Bono, or whatever, saying it. And then, you know, what's interesting is the other day I was doing a whiteboard video, and there's a gentleman, I believe his name is Henry Fernandez. He is the CEO of a company called MSCI, and they're the head ratings agency, if you will, for ESG. Mm-hmm. So if you're a company and you need an ESG score, then or if you're Larry Fink and you've got an ESG fund and you want to score for it, you go to Mr. Fernandez. And he was being interviewed by CNBC. And of course, he's saying how ESG is the future. And if businesses don't play by these rules, and they're going to go out of business, and all the funds are going to lose investors, and they're going to underperform, and yada, yada, yada. And then I think David Faber asked him a couple of questions, and he started using, again, the exact same terminology, you know, social inclusion and all these kind of buzzwords that Klaus uses. And you're like, wait a minute here, that's, you know, along with all the other research, that's just kind of the anecdotal evidence that drew me to that kind of being my base case, is that Klaus really has a lot of influence because everyone's using the same script.
Right. And that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a similar thing with me. That's, again, what kind of reinforced that, okay, yeah, I am on the right track, and I really need to shine a spotlight on this guy, because you're right. And that's the function of these meetings. You know, they have at Davos, the annual World Economic Forum meetings, they have all sorts of other things. And again, for people who are still like, oh, okay, so some, yeah, rich people, the elites, they meet and whatever, of course they do, but that doesn't mean they've published documents, you know, talking about like the Global Redesign Initiative. That's the literal title on this thing. And it's, and the blurb says, you know, what did we do? We went around and asked leaders from, you know, business and IT and government officials and if you could redesign the world, what would you do? You know what I mean? So they're openly, and it's almost like so transparent that it takes the wind out of your sails when you're saying, hey, this is something nefarious, because people say, well, come on, if it's sort of the secret cabal trying to take over the world, they wouldn't be just blaring it from their own YouTube channel. And yet they are doing that. And again, for people, just go to YouTube and look up the World Economic Forum's own channel and just watch some of their videos. And again, like George said, you'll see the buzzwords like, oh, we have to move away from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism. So everyone gets a seat at the, and part of what that means is, and this is where I'm using the language about like they're trying to subvert governments and take over, is that they're envisioning a world where it is true, like especially for countries where their governments aren't that strong, that yeah, like multinational corporations come in and they kind of call the shots. And so by me saying that, it's obviously not that I'm a fan of democratically elected governments. Of course, you know, I'm an anarcho-capitalist in my background, and you know, philosophically, I don't believe in coercion and things, you know, the state to me is inherently unjust. But also at the same time, I can see how creepy it is when they come in and, you know, the people in some country that didn't have anything to do with these other companies coming in who are, you know, backed up by the IMF and the World Bank and so on. So it's not a voluntary free market process at all. And if their government officials are beholden to or being paid off by, you know, this other group that these people have no idea, and they're announcing policies for one reason, ostensibly for the public, and yet there's, you know, the real reason they're doing it is because of something else behind closed doors. I mean, that's pretty creepy. And that this is, you know, it would be like a James Bond movie. And people have said that, and Klaus Schwab even sounds like a James Bond villain. Just listen to him talk. So that's not the strongest argument, but it does help.
Right. It doesn't hurt. Right. You know, I was listening to Tom Woods talk the other day on his podcast, and he did an episode on how progressives use language and how they paint their objectives in a way that's overly generic, and that's intentional. And when he was saying that, I was like, man, this sounds exactly like the global elite and Klaus. And I've also been listening to Thomas Sowell's book, Intellectuals in Society, mm-hmm. and kind of putting those pieces of the puzzle together. And then when I re-listened to everything that, you know, we'll call him the global elite, Klaus more specifically, says, it makes a lot of sense why he uses that script, right? Because none of his objectives are quantifiable. None. Like we need global inclusion or economic inclusion. What does that even mean? No one knows what that means, and there's no way to measure it. Therefore, Tom was saying the examples he used was like the war on drugs or the war on terrorism. Like there's no end game there. There's no end point. So it can just go on indefinitely. And the solution is always to give the central planners more power and more control. And so this is by design. So did you notice that specifically when you were doing your research on not just Klaus, but Noah and all these other people at the IMF and the UN and whatnot?
Yeah, definitely. Like I say, these buzzwords, you know, diversity, inclusion, equity, that kind of stuff. But also, yeah, the stakeholder capitalism, that's a great one, because, again, it's what that means is we can override, you know, profit seeking business and what they want for the shareholders. So it gives them the wild card to come in and tell corporations, you know, you can't just engage in voluntary transactions. We're going to tell, you know, dictate things to you, because shareholder capitalism would be that the corporation gets to do, you know, what it wants to do, as far as it's not, you know, violating contracts and whatever, violating property rights. So it gives them a while. But then who are the stakeholders? Like, for any issue, you could come up with all sorts of people who could be affected and therefore ought to have a seat at the table. But as someone was pointing, I was reading, it was interesting because the people on the left also, a lot of them are skeptical of Klaus Schwab and these guys. You know what I mean? So people on the right, like Glenn Beck or whatever, are skeptical, you know, coming from their vantage point. But then people on the left also, for perhaps slightly different motivations. But the people on the left, it's more because they believe in democracy and they can see how, well, wait a minute, this is this cabal of unelected people, many of whom are from the private sector, who are coming in and like telling governments around the world, this is what your policy is going to be. So that's why they don't like it. But yeah, when you using the term stakeholder capitalism, you might think that means like, oh, there should be a bunch of labor unions and indigenous groups. And that's how they talk. But in practice, it mostly is like big banks and things like that. So it is funny how, you know, they don't even live up to their own rhetoric, even though, like you say, it is very amorphous and hard to pin down. But it's not actually that the, you know, the people representing the indigenous groups have the same seat at the table as somebody who is HSBC Bank or something.
Yeah, you know, I want to dive into that further. I wanted to mention that I did some research for several whiteboard videos, and I found that the World Economic Forum, it wasn't called this back then. I can't recall what Klaus called it, but he set it up in 1971. Mm-hmm. And in 1968, the Club of Rome was started. And which sounds like a conspiracy group in and of itself, but it's actually not. They still exist today. And in 72, their famous paper came out called Limits to Growth, which was basically a reinvention of all these Malthusian ideas. And then in 1973, I noticed that Klaus invited the guy who wrote the paper and started the Club of Rome to be the headline speaker at the Davos event in 1973. And I think that really shaped Klaus's worldview. And I know that that Noah isn't kind of a Malthusian, but it seems like a lot of them, the global elite, are, i.e. Bill Gates, you know, that the population is growing exponentially and we just don't have enough resources, therefore we're going to run out. And it seems like, you know, I've given this a lot of thought with my whiteboard videos, and it seems like, if I was to simplify their three main objectives, it would be to limit the consumption of energy, mm-hmm, by global populations, decrease population growth, and some people would say just decrease the population. And then third would be to usurp power and control. If you look at everything that they push and their ideas and what they say, whether it's, you know, overly generic or wildly, you know, complicated to the point where it doesn't mean anything, like the fourth industrial revolution, I think if you look at it through that lens, it starts to make a lot of sense. So do you have any ideas on that? Then I want to move back over to the shareholder capitalism.
Sure. So great. So an interesting tidbit in this. So again, I can't recommend enough. It's Johnny Vedmore's piece, folks. And it's just, if you type his name and say Klaus Schwab and How I Learned to Love the Bomb, it'll come up. But he's going through the mentors, the people that sort of recruited Klaus Schwab and you know, or helped him or urged him to set up the what is now called the World Economic Forum. And one of them was Herman Kahn, who many people say was the actual inspiration for Dr. Strangelove. Like, he was the real life version of that, you know, Kubrick used in his movie. And what's interesting there is Kahn didn't agree with the Club of Rome stuff. And so he actually distanced himself, you know, he was instrumental in getting Klaus Schwab up and running. But then when Schwab went off with the Club of Rome people, Kahn, you know, distanced himself. So anyway, it's just interesting to see that these people don't always think alike. They can disagree with each other. But yeah, it's, and again, it's hard to get inside somebody's head. Like, do they really believe these things, or is it just convenient? Who can say? But yeah, the climate change stuff, the population control, you know, zero population growth, or like you say, even shrinking it. Once you open up that Pandora's box, that can justify just about anything you want. You know, you can clearly, I mean, it's not just direct emissions. So energy sector, transportation sector, you know, nutrition, so agriculture, like just think of all the things that these campaigns that are related to ostensibly climate change. And so you can see how all that comes together. And yeah, coming down to, well, yeah, you can't have more than one child per family because, look, you know, population control and or population growth and, you know, the earth can't carry that many people, that sort of thing. So yes, they do, you know, that Malthusian mindset comes in, and also just the pessimism, like the need, like, hey, somebody has to be in control. Cause if you just let these systems run spontaneously, disaster will occur. Like, so that's sort of a, you know what I mean? Like there, it seems like that's part of the difference in the two frameworks, is that people who believe in freedom and that, oh no, if, you know, if things come up, there'll be feedback cycles and people will realize, I don't remember the first person I saw frame it this way, but one way of looking at it is, you know, there's two types of people. Some look at other humans as a bunch of bellies to feed, and others look at a bunch of humans as a bunch of, you know, brains and minds that might come up with, you know, novel ways to solve problems. And there was, Steve Landsberg said this, he was given a talk on the economics of population, and he said, I'm blanking out on the name. It was an older sitcom, but I can't, now I'm blanking on the name, but he said there was a funny scene where one of the guys has like seven kids and somebody's like kind of harassed, cause this was in the '70s, you know, when the population bomb, Paul Ehrlich and stuff was big and somebody was harassing the guy, like, hey, why do you know, you're having so many kids with the sprout. And the guy's answer was to say, oh, well, I want to have a bunch of kids, cause maybe one of them will, you know, find a way to grow more food or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, and that's, so just again, showing the different ways of looking at it. But you're right. This, the Club of Rome stuff, it's, and let me, the last thing I'll say on this, I'm not merely speculating. For example, Naomi Klein, I don't know if you're familiar with her. She wrote this, I don't know, 10 years ago at this point, but she has an essay where she openly said she wasn't all into the climate change stuff just because she thought it was a scientific thing and, hey, let the scientists argue about that. But then she said, when I realized that the policies that would be needed in order to solve the climate crisis were exactly the ones that would promote, you know, equality between the sexes and would, you know, restore dignity to indigenous people and all these other things and restrain consumer capitalism that I supported already, that's when I embraced, you know, this. So she's not saying the science is fake or that I don't believe, you know what I mean? But she is saying the reason I jumped both feet into climate change is when I realized that what people were saying were the solutions were things that I already, as a progressive leftist, supported anyway. That's now why, you know, she openly says that. So, you know, I'm not just putting words in their mouth, that this is clearly, you know, a very convenient way of, you know, it's sort of like an analogy. A lot of Austrians explain the success of Keynesian economics in the 30s, not merely on its intellectual merits, but that, oh, a lot of government officials realized, oh, if we advance that, that gives us an excuse to spend a lot, you know, to deficit spend.
Yeah, great example.
And so, you know, is that real, you know, is it truly just on the merits, or, you know, is there's kind of a huge incentive? And then why? I wonder why it is that all the major publicly funded universities have a bunch of Keynesians in their economics department and not a bunch of, you know, rabid Rothbardians.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the same thing with war as well. And I've said so many times that, you know, forget your opinion on climate change. It's you've got to realize that even if you're a diehard greenie, the global elite don't care about the temperature in the ocean. They don't care about icebergs. They don't care about polar bears. They care about, I think, those three main objectives. And it's that climate change is kind of like a Trojan horse that allows them to push, that just so happens to you know, achieve those objectives of usurping power and control. When you were saying that, it reminded me of that quote from Henry Kissinger, you know, Klaus's biggest influence or mentor. And it was something to the effect where he said, if you control the food, you control the people. If you control the energy, you control countries. And if you control money, you control the world.
And they're 3 for 3, right?
Yeah.
or getting close.
Yeah. Yeah. So now let's go back to shareholder capitalism, because I want to go, you're obviously a PhD economist, and I want to go over the economics of shareholder capitalism and maybe try to play devil's advocate. And I remember actually Milton Friedman discussed this extensively in a few speeches that I've listened to on YouTube back in the 1970s. this idea that corporations should be more responsible and they should invest in, you know, in climate change or green energy, or they should do the bidding. They should do more, quote unquote, good instead of just having this profit motive. And Friedman broke that down and he said, well, wait a minute, you've got to understand that corporations are just simply people, that they aren't some abstract, you know, alien entity. And you have to realize that shareholders are people. So basically what do you, Friedman, his argument was, well, what you're doing is you're saying you want that CEO to have more control over the profit stream from that corporation to do whatever it is he wants to do that's going to enrich him and give him more power and control, instead of taking that profit and having it go directly to the shareholders, the individuals, and then let them invest or let them give to any charity that they want to give to. So why should, you know, what we're doing is we're saying that shareholder capitalism is this, you know, is good and it's charitable, but all it's doing is saying we want the charity to be more centrally planned. And then that gives the power and the control to the CEO. And if Klaus is influencing the CEO, then by default, that gives him the power and the control. Excuse me, guys, I've got a tail end of a cold here. So what are your thoughts on that, from, especially with your background in, as a PhD economist?
Sure. So right, you did a great job summarizing. And it occurred to me, I don't know that I've seen anyone do this, but maybe one way of just motivating Friedman's point to somebody who's maybe who's skeptical, and I'm sure, George, your audience is not necessarily that group, but imagine if a company came out and said, hey, you know, because we support whatever, the spotted owl, we're going to, out of our employee, you know, the money that we otherwise would owe our employees next month in terms of payroll, we're gonna reduce that by 1% and donate that to support the spotted owls. And you can imagine people would say, whoa, that, you know, that's, who are you? You know, if the workers want to go ahead and do that, then go ahead and pay them what you owe them, you know, their wages and salaries. And then if you want to, like, give them the information in case they're not aware of the plight of the spotted owl, you know, you can go ahead and give them the information and then say to them, if you want to donate, go ahead. But to just take, you know, their money in a sense and donate on their behalf in order to really make a difference, to help, you know, coordinate things, a lot of people would understand that, no, that's not your decision to make. Just, you know, you pay the workers what you owe them, let the workers, you know, in their own weigh the pros and cons of various competing ends. It could be other philanthropic things and so forth. And so likewise, that's what it is with the shareholders, that the corporation, you know, we have revenues, we have costs, we have this amount, we put this aside or whatever, and we have stuff that we're ready to distribute as dividends to the shareholders. Oh, and if instead of that, oh, what if we take 1% and go donate it to support, you know, malaria nets in Africa? Again, the logic is, well, wait a minute, why is the corporate management making a decision based on money that otherwise would have gone to the shareholders? Just if you want the shareholders to effectively give, to have less, to free up more money to, for donations, then talk to them. Don't, you know, don't try to short circuit the process. So that's Friedman's argument. I suppose there's a little bit. So I think, in terms of the strict economics, I mean, everything I said is totally valid. And, you know, that's what Friedman's basic argument was. There is something to be said, though, in terms of, like, coordination problems or whatever. So my point is, even in a genuinely free society, I don't think it's wrong, for example, like, you go to a Little League game and the kids' jerseys all have some company name on it. You know, like, oh, local Jimmy's Pizzeria supports this team or something. You know what I mean? Like, you could get real anal and say, well, why is Jimmy's Pizzeria doing that? You know, they should and it's for advertising and goodwill, and, you know, so there's things like that. So it's my concern is, if you push that analysis too far, it ends up sounding like the economists who say Christmas is inefficient, because, you know what I mean? Like, you should, at best, you should just give everybody checks and let them go buy what they want. And, you know, I mean, and so you see how that kind of leaves something out. So there is something like that. But again, you know, I think it's partly a matter of extremes, and certainly what is happening now with corporations posturing and trying to be good corporate citizens and that sort of thing. And, you know, BP calling itself Beyond Petroleum and all that, that's not a spontaneous outcome that I think that's akin to, you know, some local pizza shop supporting the Little League team. That, you know, I think that is due to, they're either trying to put it this way, when the state has all this power to make or destroy individual corporations, through merger approvals or onerous, tax treatment and whatnot, you kind of have to stay on their good side. And so there always is that big club there. And so again, with this stuff, yeah, I don't look at this as purely a voluntary outcome. And not to just say, oh, it's all these poor, innocent corporations that are getting smacked around by the big, bad government, big brother. It's kind of a two-way street where, like we said, a lot of these corporations are the ones sending their people to Davos and helping set this agenda. And so it's a kind of thing where, the bigger players might set the agenda, and that kind of locks out the more middle of the road, or not middle of the road, but like mid-level companies who can't now compete.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. You know, we live in a world today where you got to think this through. If you're a mega corporation, let's say, you've got two ways to compete with everyone that's coming up and nipping at your heels. You could, in a world of big government, you can just use political pull and influence and ESG. I mean, ESG is a perfect example of that, that you can just influence the person that's giving you the rating or whatever politician. And then you get all of these benefits for having a high ESG score. And that limits the small guy's ability to compete with you. Or, Walmart arguing for a higher minimum wage is another example. This is not just corporations doing quote unquote good. This is them using government to build a moat and to build a monopoly. So if you're, even if you're someone on the far left, I think, and you want to reduce the size or reduce the power of these mega corporations, I think you first and foremost have to understand that we've got to reduce the size of government. Because if government didn't have as much power and control, the corporations wouldn't be using them in the first place. And then Klaus, on top of that, he wouldn't have as much pull. And it just, the whole process goes in reverse. But if the governments get bigger and bigger and bigger, then the corporations are going to leverage them more and more and more. Then the governments are going to be incentivized to only to eliminate the small competitors, the mom and the pop, the mid-sized small businesses, because they can influence and they get the kickbacks from these huge mega corporations. And then Klaus is incentivized to have all of the means of production, let's say, more centralized with these governments and mega corporations, because he can influence 100 people a lot easier than he can influence millions of people.
Right, exactly. And, another good example of that is like Exxon actually, originally supported, in terms of like, the donations they would give some of the organizations that now would be deemed as climate deniers. But then they switched and they were all, they're for carbon tax and they're supporting all this stuff and whatever. And part of it is, I think they just made a judgment that, something's coming, we want to be at the table, not on the menu, that kind of phraseology. But, and they made a bunch of investments like a natural gas plays. And so, they ran the nut and realized, okay, that because with a modest sized carbon tax, for, you know, in case your listeners don't know, that right now for the foreseeable future, a modest sized carbon tax actually would help like natural gas, because it would kill coal, but then, you know, wind and solar can't fill the gap right now just for various practical reasons. And so that would really expand, you know, the use of natural gas for electricity production. So somebody who was heavily into natural gas versus some of their competitors might favor a carbon tax, you know, just for purely profitable reasons to, you know, to justify their investments. So, you know, there's lots of things like that. And again, with this ESG, and just real quickly, I saw someone come and give a talk when I was still at Texas Tech about, you know, how the Chinese system works with the social credit rating scores. And what was interesting, so it was the kind of thing where, you know, if you made a Facebook post or, you know, something on the online critical of the Chinese government, you know, your score would get dinged. And then the ramifications, it's not necessarily for something that was relatively trivial, that agents of the state would come in the middle of the night and disappear you. It's just, you might not be able to ever rent a hotel room now, or at least, you know, for your punishment period while you sat in the corner and thought about what you did. And so then that raised the question, though, well, wait a minute, why does the hotel care? You know, like, and then they were saying it was kind of like a credit score, like how, in a sense, that's like a voluntary, you know, market-based thing. Like your credit score, it's not that the government tells you what your credit score is. Those are just groups who give opinions, and they can't, you know, the group that's rating your credit score here in the West, it's not that they say to a lender, you know, we'll shoot you if you lend money to this person. They're just saying, no, this is our opinion as to what his credit score is. Do what you want. And then, you know, that has ramifications. So I was, you know, I asked the presenter, well, wait a minute, why does the hotel care? You know, if you're a hotel in China and someone comes to rent a room, you know, why, and you look up on the database and say, oh, you got dinged last month because you said something negative about the, you know, the Communist Party. So no, you can't stay here. Like, why do they care that, you know, your views on the Communist Party presumably don't have much to do with whether you're going to, you know, trash the hotel room. And then the answer, of course, was, oh, because that itself is one of the ratings. If you are a business and you do business with clients who, or with customers who got dinged, then you get dinged, you know? So it was sort of like a hierarchy of ratings. So it was weird, like, to figure out where does the actual state coercion come in. It was like several layers removed. Like, a lot of it was just this quasi-voluntary rating system of like, you know, private sector punishment or ostracism.
And yeah, so we see that with, you know, do you know who Mark Andreessen is?
I know the name.
Yeah. He's the gentleman that I believe he built Netscape, one of the first web browsers, mm-hmm. back in the, I believe it was the early 90s. And now he's a big a VC guy in Silicon Valley. But he came out with this theory that I heard, that in society today, we have to have something to be hysterical about. And we can't look at whatever the current hysteria is. We can't look at it through the lens of critical thinking until we've moved on to the next hysteria. So he used the example of COVID, where mm-hmm. you've got this massive hysteria and people just cannot think about it without using just complete emotion and being whipped up in this emotional frenzy. But he says now that this hysteria has moved on to, let's say, Russia, Ukraine, now all of a sudden we can look back in retrospect and be very quote unquote scientific mm-hmm. about the actual facts in the data. And I thought that was, you know, a fascinating hypothesis, but then, you know, you understand that. And if that's true, then you look at it through the lens of what you're just saying, where the government almost doesn't need to set up this social credit score. We thrust it upon ourselves because society is at a point where they're just looking for the next thing to be hysterical about. And I think about all the companies and the corporations that really stopped doing business in Russia. Mm-hmm. Or you think about all these bars that are no longer carrying Smirnoff vodka, when the owner of Smirnoff is actually a UK company. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with Russia whatsoever. And it's like they are, you know, they are censoring themselves, because if they don't, then society will be outraged, this outrage culture. So it sounds similar to what you're saying there, that, you know, even though we might not have that specifically or explicitly in the United States, kind of in an indirect way, we do.
Right. And another example of that was when the George Floyd protests were, you know, really in full swing. If you remember, like, all the, how many businesses, like, were, you know, saying Black Lives Matter and stuff. And it was like, if you didn't, you know, serious ramifications could occur. And it was, you know, interesting just to see, like, well, how is it? And obviously, like, if there was the threat of, you know, somebody actually destroying your property, where, okay, but a lot of it was just, you know, organized boycotts and whatever. And so, you know, again, it was a similar phenomenon there.
How do we solve that, Bob, from a free market standpoint? Because, you know, another thing, if you want to talk about a script now with the World Economic Forum and all these politicians, it's disinformation. We need to stop. You know, I don't know if you saw Obama at Stanford the other day. He did this whole speech on how disinformation could destroy democracy. And then, of course, the next day, Hillary Clinton comes out and says disinformation. Now you're hearing Klaus talk about, I've heard him recently say that this is, you know, we need to have a war against disinformation. And so, but looking at it through the lens of free market capitalism, how do we do that with the social media companies? Because, you know, the argument is, even from the conservatives, is always, well, we need to come in and regulate Facebook and Instagram or whatever, Twitter, because they're a public square. And I always, I'm a little hesitant there because, you know, the solution being bigger government, that never sits well with me. So being the free market guy you are and the economist, how would you solve that problem?
Well, before I say the tentative solutions, yeah, let's just elaborate on what the problem is. You're right, George, that so in a totally free market world, it wouldn't be much of an issue. Things would be voluntary and you would need, you know, some type of ratings agencies, right? Like, in other words, I don't think there's any problem with having agencies that give you a credit score. And, you know, and if they, and there should be multiple ones, it shouldn't just be a monopoly, and, you know, make sure, you know, and if there's a problem, you report it. And, you know, presumably if some company systematically was giving reports that had, or scores that didn't have much to do with your actual ability to repay, then they would go out of business for, you know, that sort of thing. And so even in principle, and I've written stuff about, you know, if we had a society where there wasn't a monopoly state that ran a court system and police and things like, you know, how could that work with private judges? And there could be, you know, fraternal organizations that sort of vouch for their members. And, you know, and the analog I used that's, you know, in the real world today is something like medical malpractice insurance. That, you know, if you're a doctor, you have an insurance policy saying if it's shown that I harm someone out of negligence or whatever, then, you know, it rectifies it and I pay premiums. And or your automobile insurance, you know, you can't drive on the road unless you have this policy. So you can imagine just those things being more elaborate in a genuinely free society, and that maybe for you to work somewhere, you got to have an insurance policy. So, hey, if you just go postal one day and start shooting up your coworkers, you've got this policy in place that indemnifies them. And, you know, there's things like that. You could imagine things like that. But the problem is right now, of course, we're not in a genuine free market. And that's what I was getting at before, that Klaus Schwab and these groups, like, they figured out a way to kind of just use, you know, the what seems to be a voluntary private market setting. And so, yeah, Facebook and Twitter can set whatever rules they want. Hey, it's a private company. And so, but if the reason they're setting those policies isn't purely, you know, to maximize profit or whatever, but it's because there's ultimately maybe two or three steps removed the threat of government, you know, a government club, just like the hotels in China. The reason they're not renting the room to the person, they could just say, oh, no, it's just we want to be responsible corporate citizens. And this person has a low credits, you know, social rating. And so we're not renting. But if really it's because they know if we get caught renting to too many people, you know, who the government deems to be undesirables, then we're going to somehow get in trouble. You know what I mean? So it's that sort of thing. So that's kind of where we are. And I would say I understand people who think, okay, so yeah, there is a role for regulation here. Don't tell me, oh, Twitter's a private company, can do whatever it wants. Because as you just admitted, we're not in this laissez-faire utopia. And so let's go ahead and regulate. There's no principled reason not to. But okay, even on its own terms, though, if the reason we're in this trouble is because nefarious groups are able to use the power of the state, well, then you having, you know, some sort of bill of rights for social media, that's not going to be respected, just like the Second Amendment's not respected. You know what I mean? So I think it's naive that it's, you know, that's not going to be the solution, like you say. And I think ultimately the only real long-term one is to sort of secede either de facto or de jure. and to like try to get oases of, you know, land or corporations or whatnot that are largely as much outside the scope or the jurisdiction of these entities as possible, where you can, you know, set up your rival thing. And I know that's easier said than done, but again, it's that, you know, just because it's difficult doesn't mean, oh, let's embrace some other thing that's not going to work, because at least that sounds better.
Yeah. What are your thoughts right now on DeSantis and Disney? Because that kind of, I know everyone in the libertarian, or not everyone, but a lot of people in the libertarian and kind of on the right, in that camp, they're like, oh yeah, good, go DeSantis. But then I'm like, I don't know. Let's think this through here. We're going from, let's do low tax. Now all of a sudden we want Disney to pay higher tax just because they did something we don't agree with. And I don't know, I'm for all corporations paying a lot less tax, even Disney. What are your thoughts there?
Right. It was a similar thing too, with like under in the COVID, you know, when that was the hysteria of the day too, like with Texas, and I can't remember if Florida did it too, but where, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, you know, no entity in our state should be punished. You know, if the feds try to come in and fine you for not enforcing a, you know, having a vax passport requirement at your door, you know, we will do everything in our power as the state government to keep the feds out of your face and to not cooperate with them. That would have been great, you know, but then to go beyond that and say, even if you as a private business want to have your own vax policy, you're prohibited from doing that within our state. To me, that was an overshoot. And I know the arguments were to say, oh, but the only reason the private businesses were doing that was because they were worried about federal retaliation and da da da. So it wasn't valid. I get all that. But like you said, again, George, it's when it made me very uncomfortable and state governments started doing things that prima facie were interference with private property. Cause again, that's, and to say, well, we mean well, or in this case, you know, it's the bad guys and, you know, this is for a good cause. Well, right. But that's the justification for every time the government comes in and does something, you know,
or playing devil's advocate. I think they'd say, well, they were getting a break in the first place. So all DeSantis is doing is leveling the playing field between Disney and the other corporations.
Yeah, that's what they could say. And I guess the, like you say, the response would be, okay, we're going to take away Disney's advantage by giving the same breaks to every company or something like that. But so yes, I agree with you that raising taxes is not the way to, you know, move towards more liberty. That's not.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting argument there. And I don't really have a position, but I'm just, what I'm trying to say, I guess, is my default isn't necessarily DeSantis is doing something that I approve of. I guess it's just something there. I don't know, when government gets involved like that, but I guess they got involved in the first place, but I don't know. It isn't clear cut for me, I guess.
Right. And again, I've seen these arguments too. And the thing that really troubles me is I've seen a lot of more conservative types who are like frustrated with libertarians. And believe me, I'm frustrated with libertarians on a daily basis myself. So I get that. But it's where they're sort of recoiling and then like sort of mocking the idea that, oh, you guys have your principles. Or like, it's like, in other words, it was some of these groups, and I've seen their infighting, it's gotten to the point where they're sort of just openly ridiculing the notion that you might have principles and things that, hey, we're not allowed to do this. This is the kind of thing that the bad guys do. We don't do this. And I mean, you could push that to an extreme. Like, yes, there's terrorist groups. Does that mean that, you know, if you're fighting them, that, you know, you should take other people's children as hostages or whatever? Well, they're doing it to us, you know, and it gets real messy, obviously. But so to me, yes, one could reasonably disagree about saying, hey, whether such and such is an initiation of coercion or an unwarranted move by the state government, you know, DeSantis or in Texas, what have you. And that's fine. But again, what really alarms me is when people take it to the next level and say the very idea that you're worried about, are we doing something immoral? Are we using evil to achieve a good end? Like, that's just silly. Like, you know, only losers worry about that. If we keep worrying about that, we're going to end up in front of the firing squad. Like, I've seen language like that where it's like, hey, by any means necessary, we're going to go ahead and achieve liberty in our lifetime kind of thing. And to me, that's when you're throwing in the towel. And if you're just saying we're not going to be guided by principles whatsoever, that to me, that's definitely wrong.
That, to me, that's the the fine line there, the line in the sand, where and why principles are so important. Because if you abandon them, you inevitably get on this slippery slope where if you take it to its logical conclusion, it doesn't end well. You know, it's right. The same thing with, you know, the government getting, you know, doing something that we might not like, or, you know, take it the other way. Maybe you were in favor of a vaccine mandate. Okay, that's fine. But you just keep in mind, if you're that's a slippery slope, because you give the government that type of power and control, and I can guarantee you they're going to use it against you or something that you believe in the very near future. And that's why I think the principles are so important.
Right. And also too, it's, you know, I don't have any problem with DeSantis per se. You know, it's not that I'm worried about him being a dictator in waiting necessarily, but again, if people support what he's doing, then the question is, okay, the next person that comes in to that office, you know, are they then going to do things that even their current supporters are like, ooh, you know, maybe we did open up the, you know, let the genie out of the bottle with this one.
Yeah. You know, the example I always used during COVID was 1905, the Jacobson versus Massachusetts Supreme Court decision that allowed the state to fine the individual for not getting the smallpox vaccine. That was the precedence for the 1927 decision that basically legalized eugenics, the Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes, came out, all of them, but he came out with the speech afterwards, but he basically used that as precedence as to why they could force sterilization on people with under a certain IQ.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, so I wasn't aware of those details, but that's chilling. And right. It's, you know, when you allow these principles, you know, open the door to things that on the, you know, seems like a fairly innocuous and, oh, come on, you know, don't be a fear monger and don't use these slippery slope arguments or whatever. And it's like, well, hasn't history shown us that a slippery slope, like generally speaking, when people have warned, hey, if we allow this, then this is going to happen 20 years from now. And they sound insane when they're saying that. And yet down the road, it often happens even sooner than they warned about.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, I know we're running short on time, Bob. Since you've got such an incredible background in economics, I wanted to ask you one thing that always kind of confuses me about the mainstream economic view, we'll call it. When I listen to Jerome Powell or Janet Yellen or the central bankers in general, it seems to me they always conflate inflation with economic growth. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, I've never taken a finance class or an economics class or business class for that matter in my life. I just do enough of it, enough research to, or I obsess about it enough to do these whiteboard videos. But that never made any sense to me, that those were just synonymous, that if we had inflation, that meant the economy was booming. And I'm like, didn't the 1970s kind of show us that that wasn't necessarily true, that you can have inflation and we can have lower economic output? What am I missing there? And if I'm not missing something, why do they conflate those two things?
Okay, yeah, so you're not missing anything. Another example too is like Venezuela or Zimbabwe, you know, where they had hyperinflations and yet the unemployment rate was really high too. You know, kind of people are eating dogs and things. So, you know, so that does show that, yes, theoretically, it is possible you could have very high price inflation coupled with awful real economic.
Or, I'm sorry, problems. Is there argument that when inflation is high and the unemployment rate is low, then that must mean that there's, you know, more economic output? Is that a new argument?
Well, I think it might be more closer to this. So the more nuanced one is they might say a strong economy goes hand in hand with like positive price pressures or something. So yeah, what's called the Phillips curve, there's this alleged trade-off, at least in the short run, between unemployment and price. I'm going to keep saying price inflation. They would just say inflation, but you know, I want to distinguish. And so, right. The idea is other things equal that, yeah, if you, cause they're coming from a Keynesian mindset where demand is what drives things. And so the idea is if there's a recession or sluggish growth, it's because there's not enough spending either on consumption or investment from the private sector. And so, you know, how do you goose that? The government could either come in and do it with deficit spending or yeah, if they flood the market with more money, then that will tend to boost spending. So that drives, you know, an increase, you know, firms hire more and where they bid up wages and, you know, workers they work longer shifts or whatnot, lowers unemployment. But now that because there's more spending, that means prices tend to go up. So that's where they're coming from. And then the other hand, you know, if the economy is overheating, if prices are rising at an unacceptably high rate, then the Fed needs to slam on the brakes. So that's going to push down inflation, but then it's going to make unemployment spike. So that's why in their framework, they would think it would tend to be the case that you would see a strong, robust economy with high growth, you know, real growth going hand in hand with low unemployment and, you know, rising prices. But you're right, George. There's no reason conceptually that has to be the case. You know.
Yeah. So that's next. So why is that from an Austrian view? Why is that wrong?
Okay, so it's wrong because it's a very myopic view where they're just thinking, it's true if you get locked into this cycle where the Fed or the central bank in general is, you know, showering gobs of money and that's going to lower interest rates artificially. That's going to cause this apparent boom. Prices are going to be rising, and then when that gets out of hand, then they slam the brakes. So that's true, but there's nothing that says they got to keep doing that alternating cycle of just pumping in money and then slamming the brakes and then pumping in money again. You know what I mean? In other words, if you just had a purely market-based money and banking system, then you wouldn't have these wild ups and downs. And you could have, you know, long-term sustained real economic growth with, you know, it depends what, you know, if you're using gold coins as the base money, then prices would either be stable or they might even be gently falling, you know, over time.
While economic growth was increasing, like the late 1800s.
Right. And partly has to do with expectations too. So with a lot of, it's kind of like with Bitcoin, when people say, the hard cap of 21 million, doesn't that mean, you know, it could never serve as the global currency? Well, no, it could. There's nothing, you know, it's just people would take that into account. And so, but they would know, 20 years from now, prices quoted in Bitcoin will be a lot lower, you know, as real output increases, that means the price per unit, you know, would go down if the money stock is constant. So, you know, people are allowed to do that, to take that into consideration. So it's true, switching, you know, from one regime to another might cause some temporary dislocation. But in principle, if inflation is colloquially defined as too much money chasing too few goods, well, then other things equal, the more, you know, goods increase, that would lower inflation, right? There's more goods available now per the number of dollars in existence or whatever. So yeah, in general, it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, and the other thing that didn't make any sense to me is if you have lower prices just by economics 101, shouldn't you have higher demand? Isn't that kind of the way it goes? But they say that lower prices decrease. And I know that in today's environment with the debt being at all-time high, that is true, that if we have lower prices, it could lead to lower demand. That's the way I always frame that argument. I say you got to ask yourself if lowering prices increases demand or it decreases demand. And if it decreases demand, then yeah, you've got big problems. But the only way lower prices will decrease demand is if you got a debt problem to begin with.
Yeah. So there's that element. And with all this too, you just got to be clear on, you know, your initial equilibrium and then what are you changing? So if what you're changing is you're sucking half the money out of existence, and so that's why prices tend to fall, that might cause, you know, a depression temporarily just because people are shocked. But if the reason prices are falling is because real output, you know, there's some innovation and people can produce more, well, then there's no reason, you know, for that would actually go hand in hand with prosperity. You know, standards of living would rise as we're able to produce more with the same amount of inputs.
Yeah. Yeah. And Bob, I just remembered I said it was going to be 45 minutes and we've already gone after an hour. So I sincerely apologize. I totally lost track of time and what I was doing there. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go? And they've got to check out your podcast. It's awesome.
Oh, I appreciate that. So yeah, my podcast is go to bobmurphyshow.com, and then I'm on Twitter as Bob Murphy Econ.
All right. Do you have a website or anything?
Sure. Yeah. Consultingbyrpm.com.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks a lot for your time, Bob. Can't wait to do it again.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Do you enjoy watching these interviews I do for the Rebel Capitalist Show? Well, if so, you would absolutely love Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the conference I do twice per year, and we've had speakers like Robert Kiyosaki, Lynn Alden, Rick Rule, Jeff Snyder, and Dr. Ron Paul, just to name a few. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com and check out the next event we have scheduled in Miami. Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.